Hey, good morning. We'll be starting the class momentarily. And we'll take up the topic today of the Noahide laws in contrast to the Torah laws. Just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That'll confirm that you're picking up the audio stream correctly. Okay, Joel, thank you. And again, we'll start just in about a minute. For friends to call in. Periods intermittently throughout the session. Doug. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Okay, doing well. How you doing, Cal?
Good. Josh is here, too.
Hey, Josh. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Good to hear.
How are you?
All right.
Someone else is on?
Hey, it's Nomi.
Oh, hi, Nomi.
How you doing, Nomi?
Good.
Rabbi, can I cover off an old issue before we start?
Sure, go ahead.
The issue about meat, I can't remember, but I think it's on my to-do list, but I haven't emailed you and Josh. I did have a discussion with Rabbi Chait as a follow-up, and he did say that the idea of if you have like a pot of stew and the majority is kosher, and you pull out one piece, but you know there's some little non-kosher bit in there, but if you pull out something at random, then you're allowed to go with the majority. That apparently does follow over to Noahides. So the understanding I had would be is if we're comfortable that a majority of animals in a commercial slaughterhouse are dead before they are cut up, then if I go buy a steak at Safeway and I have essentially no idea, you know, which slaughterhouse it came from or what cow or wherever, that I can go with the majority and be safe in using that. He did make the distinction that if there was a town that had 10 butcher shops, and I knew that one of the butcher shops had non-acceptable meat, and the other 9 did have acceptable meat, but I just didn't know which one was the one that had unacceptable meat, I could not just go pick one at random and presume that I'm going with the majority.
That makes sense.
So, and I asked him about kosher meat, and he said he thought that generally the kosher meat would be dead before it was cut up, although I think we were left a little bit open-ended that it would be best to check with a shohet on that, but he was thinking that it would surprise him if it wasn't that way.
Right. I guess maybe, Josh, you should just maybe share with Rabbi Chait, you know, your findings about how there's still a twitching even long after the actual slaughter.
Doug was saying, yeah, go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, Rabbi Chait on an earlier message, phone message to me, clarified that the twitching doesn't count. That when Maimonides talks about convulsive, he's really only talking about major convulsive body movements in like the throes of death. But the nerve twitching afterwards is not what he's referring to.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, that would clear that up. One thing maybe we still should look at is, you know, like in the, you know, like in that article I sent you, like in a big slaughterhouse where it's, you know, coming in live one side to going out the other side, like, you know, 25, 30 minutes or something. As far as what the actual steps are, because it seems like they do a stunning, you know, they call it stunning, not killing. It sounds like, you know, I don't know in how many cases the animal's just kind of rendered unconscious by a blow to the head, but it may still have a heartbeat at that point. I'm not really sure. It's not really clear. But if it would go through, you know, depending on what the order of the steps are of disassembly, you know, it could still be okay, even if that is just knocking them unconscious. You know, if they would be, you know, if they'd be done with, you know, the convulsions of the actual death by the time any flesh would be removed. So, anyway, I think it's still, maybe we need to be real sure about that as far as what the steps are, you know, to say for sure that we know.
Well, it seemed to be Rabbi Chait was
in the... then would be...
Rabbi Chait seemed to be on the opinion that the animals are dead, so there should not be a problem with that.
Yeah.
But, I guess when the question arises, then you could ask the question, but... you know, go based on his, you know, his ruling, it makes it safe.
But that question, I still, go ahead.
No, Josh, are you saying then that because the animal's stunned, I guess it sounds like what you're getting to is, do we actually know that a majority of them would be dead before they're cut?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Because if they would just be unconscious, but say you still have a heartbeat and flesh is removed, and we would need to know that would be, you know, definitely a minority of the case.
Yeah.
Which my guess would be that it would be. But I mean, I'm just saying maybe look at the, you know, like how many minutes is it from... You know, like, what are the actual steps in a house like that, which I'm not really familiar with? And if it would be a case where, which it would seem like it would be, but I just don't know, where even if the animal is skinned while just unconscious, it's going to be dead by the time the actual flesh is removed. But
it sounds like there's a lot of unknowns over here.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking just as we do this, I was just looking up, probably going to pursue this further. I'll bet there is a field office of the USDA that I could at least stop in and visit and say, hey, here's our question, you know, do you all have any, you know, any thoughts about that? And if they say, no, absolutely, we inspect those all the time, and yeah, it's possible one or two will slip through, but you know, we're 100% certain that the animals are dead before they're cut. That would be one thing if they hedge and say, well, it kind of varies, and, you know, that. But it might be an easy place to start, because I don't know anyone who works for a slaughterhouse.
Well, as long as I understand, you know, what the definition of dead is that we're working with.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just unconscious, but it's, you know, like you said, Rabbi Jay said, the convulsions right at the time of death are over.
Right.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. There's also the point that, you know, once Rabbi Chay explained that the majority of the meat is okay, so then you have that ruling would apply. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, that would apply to, you have a stew and you're not sure, you know, but since there's a majority already that we know is okay, so the entire stew would be all right, because the whole stew has the majority of permissible meat. So then the rest would be nullified against it, even if you took it out. It makes sense. Yeah, it's consistent. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I got your email, by the way, about the Noahide versus Torah system, so I thought we'd just take that up today. I didn't have a chance to go further with the Koheles. We actually started doing some yesterday, but we went back over some previous, so I don't want to do any repetition. So maybe what we'll do is take up the questions that you had regarding, because it is to me, it was, first of all, I really appreciate the question, because it really opened up so many new ideas for me as I was working on the response, Doug. And just to you know, everybody else who's not familiar with what we were discussing, I'll just, you know, recap it just very briefly. The questions regarding the Noahide laws that existed prior to Sinai, prior to the giving of the Torah. So certain laws were repeated, and one law wasn't. So the question that Doug's student had in the class was, why would it be that if Noahides were given, for example, procreation, so that was given to Noah, and since no new command concerning that, maybe details were given, but since no new command about that or circumcision, that was another example the Talmud says, since those were not repeated in a command form from Sinai moving forward, so those laws are removed from being Noahide, and are now only for the Jew. If something was said to the Noahide and then repeated over again as a command after Sinai, or at Sinai actually, so then it applies to both. So those are the seven Noahide laws. There was the example of the Gidonasha, that's the sciatica, right, Doug?
Right.
Right, so the sciatica, that was taken from the story of Jacob when he wrestled with the man, and that was really like an internal battle that he had, but he was, it says he limped afterwards, so because of that the Jews wouldn't eat that part of the animal to recall the concept of man's internal struggle always to perfect himself, and that was never repeated at all from Sinai moving forward, so that is no longer for the Noahides. And I understand, Doug, that your question was, well, be that as it may, but it was only given to the Noahide group that came from the descendants of Israel. It wasn't for all of them. I think even Tosfos, you know, in the Talmud brings that down. So what we really have to do is understand what the system was before and what it is now, meaning the 7 Noahide laws prior to Sinai, and then what's that system now, and why was that law removed if it was given, for example, procreation or the prohibition of eating that part of the animal, the sciatic nerve, and the, you know, the surrounding area, I think. So why would it ultimately be removed if it was initially given? That was one main question that you shouldn't have, right?
Well, of sorts. I mean, we know the story of his wrestling with the angel, and then the hip dislocation and so forth. And the way I read Gracie's, it says, and therefore the children of Israel do not eat the displaced nerve until this day. Now, I can interpret that as just that's a practice they picked up versus a commandment. But the other thing is, it seems to focus directly on the children of Israel and doesn't seem like it's ever given as a commandment to all of mankind.
No, be that as it may, they still were Noahides at that point, prior to Sinai. So a person can still ask, well, you know, why those, you know, if those descendants remained and didn't get the Torah, they would not be observing it. Unless we want,
but it would only be that, it says only the children of Israel. It doesn't say anybody else. So even if Sinai never happened, then you might say, okay, all the descendants of Jacob would do that. But I've never heard anything that suggests that the rest of the world was obligated in that.
Right. Well, the Talmud seems to approach it just as two clean categories. Noahide versus Jew. And, I mean, the Talmud says that that's the only law that we find that was never repeated at all. And they say, therefore, there's a principle that you can't have something which a Noahide is prohibited in and the Jew is not. Now, that statement also has to be understood. Why? Why can't it be that there's something which a Noahide has a prohibition on, the Jew doesn't? So there has to be a reason behind this, too. But also just the
Hebrew Menachai was prohibition for the Noahide and not the Jew.
Hebrew Menachai? Eating from, yeah, that was a prohibition for Noahide, right? And then it was repeated over, so therefore it applies now both to the Noahide and the Jew. Since it was repeated over after
not applied to the, and I think Rabbi Chay did a tape on that. He said it doesn't apply to the Jew. Right?
No, Avram and Achai does. Certainly does. That's one of the 613.
What's Abraham Achai?
Taking a limb from the living animal and eating it.
So yeah, I was going to raise that question too, because I wasn't aware that was one of the 613.
I heard one of Rabbi Chase's things. He said that, I mean, then you guys wouldn't have a problem. You just eat kosher meat, right?
Right.
There was what he said was that you could slaughter that, you could chop its head off, and then you could take its limb, and it would be kosher for a Jew, but it wouldn't be kosher for a non-Jew.
Right, there's a short period of time in there when it's permissible to a Jew, but not a non-Jew.
Was it David Menachai?
Right, because the thing is, in that case, it's since the ritual slaughter, which is recognized by only the Jewish law, applies there. So once you have ritual slaughter, you know, which is called shechita, so once you have that, that makes the animal permissible 100%. But that same animal would not be edible to a Noahide, because since ritual slaughter is not part of their system, so if the animal's still convulsing, so that would now be considered, and the person ate something from the convulsing animal, now you're eating a limb from a living animal. It's living in terms of the framework of the Noahide, because slaughter is not recognized as permitting the animal. But the Jew has slaughter as part of their laws, so therefore, once the animal is slaughtered, that now modifies the entire beast to be edible, even if there's somewhat convulsing in there. Because that overrides.
The Jewish slaughter makes it dead for the Jew.
It makes it permissible food. But since there's no ritual slaughter recognized in the Noahide system, so now it doesn't have that that permissive quality yet. So it's a very interesting thing. It's sort of like a twilight zone. But it makes perfect sense. because only that which is part of the Noahide system can apply to him. Ritual slaughter is not part of his system, so therefore that element that permits the meat doesn't apply to him. The animal will have to be completely without, you know, motion in order that he can then take some of that meat and cook it and eat it. So that's what it means. So in that case, there's no Eirum and Echai. There's no eating a limb from a living animal in that case. But if a Jew goes over to a living animal and takes a bite out of it, that's prohibited. Because there was no slaughter that permits, you know, made the animal, rendered it into food yet. You understand, don't we?
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. I thought that it was interesting.
Okay.
I did just notice, too, and I was incorrect in a comment I made earlier. In looking at Maimonides' 613 commandments, negative 182 is eating a limb of a living creature.
Right.
So they do have that. It's just the definition of when you're living is slightly different for...
Right, exactly. The law definitely applies, right.
Yeah.
Again, you can't have a law that's applying in the Noahide system, which is not applying in the Jewish system, because if we go now to the theoretical plane to understand this principle, see, a lot of times a person can get very caught up in the Talmudic technical debates back and forth, but they don't really get down to what's the underlying principle. Once you have the underlying principle, that opens up so many doors, and it gives us such an appreciation for the design of the Torah system and the Noahide system. But initially, the Noahide system was the system. And as I mentioned in the article, there's a view in the Talmud that says that Adam, the first, only had one command, and that was that he has to accept God, meaning the law of idolatry. And the Talmud says from there he has to derive that he should also, since he has to recognize God, so therefore he would also derive that he shouldn't curse God, because that would fall underneath that type of an understanding of God being the authority and what would be demanded of man based on that relationship, that he's subservient to God. And also he should understand to set up courts, so therefore he shouldn't just live by his own views, but he should follow God's will. So that would be the concept of setting up courts. So you see that there was the idea that I was bringing out was that there was the Torah system was really an addendum and not a complete replacement of the previous seven Noahide laws. Because God took those Noahides, those descendants of Abraham, and as Maimonides says in his Laws of Kings, it's chapter 9, law 1, he says that there was six laws given to... This is going to a different view, of course. There were six laws given to Adam. One more was added to Noah that that they shouldn't eat the limb from a living animal, because animals weren't permitted up to that point. So since they weren't permitted, no law makes sense. Don't eat the limb of a living animal, because they couldn't eat animals until Noah. Once God permitted meat to Noah, now there made sense to say, now when you eat the meat, make sure you're not eating it while it's still alive. And then a few other laws were given, that Abraham would do circumcision, and Jacob, Isaac or Jacob actually added on tithes, giving 10%, and also was commanded in the sciatica nerve because of that event, that they shouldn't eat that from the animal. And then he says, until the Torah was, and he says, other laws were given even by Moses' father, Amram. They gave additional commands while they're in Egypt, until the law was completed by Moses. So you see, Maimonides uses the term, the law was completed. That implies that there was a progression, and that what the Torah given at Sinai was not the complete replacement. It was now to further add on. And that laid the foundation for the rest of what we discussed, which, you know, I'd like to do today, just to take up and, you know, clean up any side points, but just to keep our focus. So the question is, what did happen prior to Sinai, and what happened at Sinai in terms of the new law being given? You had seven laws or so before, and then you had the whole new system given at Sinai. So how do we look at the previous laws? So that's where the Talmud comes in and says, anything which was repeated again in a command at Sinai, that applies to both, to Jew and to Gentile. And the reason they say that, if we think about that, is because if they already have, if those Noahides from, you know, Abraham's lineage, they already had this set of seven laws, the few others, the circumcision, so on, they had like 10 laws. So why was it necessary to repeat them over if they already have them? God never said that you're losing them, that I have to command you again. So the Talmud says the reason they repeat it over is not for the new nation of the Jews, that were the transformed Noahides, but they're repeated over for the other Noahides that are not part of that seed, that not part of that lineage. That's why there's a repetition. There's no need to tell the group of Abraham's descendants that you have to keep observing these seven, because they were never abrogated from them. So once God commanded it, that's for all time. So the Talmud asks, so what's the reason it's repeated? It's repeated in order to tell you that don't think that now God's giving a new system that the old system is gone. See, it's not a replacement. If it was a replacement, if the 613 system was a complete new law for mankind, so now you would say that God is completely abrogating everything he set up to this point, and now here's a whole new system. So now it makes sense to repeat everything, because now it's a new system. But since we see, as Maimonides says, that it's an addendum, it's a completion that was given for Moses, so now it's a completion, so what's the reason why you're repeating certain laws? So it can't be for the group that still has to maintain them. It must be then for the other group, meaning Noahites. It didn't come from Jacob. So therefore they have to keep whatever's repeated over. But what is not repeated over? Right? That is something which the Noahides don't have anymore. Because of the principle that there can't be something which is in the Noahide set of laws that the Jews don't have. Now what's the reason you think for that?
Rabbi, can I go back?
Yes. Yeah, it gets a little confusing, so yeah, we should definitely ask you questions as they come up. I'm sorry.
Okay, so Maimonides in chapter 9 is saying that essentially the seven seven Noahide laws were given to Adam, and he lists them there right at the beginning of chapter 9. So then he comes on, and interestingly, he does not put be fruitful and multiply as one of those.
Right, I think the Talmud says, because, if I'm not mistaken, that was given to Adam alone. So since it wasn't like for everybody, if I'm not mistaken, that's why that wasn't counted.
Okay, so hold that thought. Then he goes on and he's saying the prohibition against eating flesh from a living animal was added for Noah. So actually, he's claiming six were given to Adam, and that the prohibition against living animals was given to Noah. Yet, let me just stop there. Even right after the flood, he repeats the command to be fruitful and multiply twice, and Rashi says one time it's a blessing, and then Rashi refers to the second instance of it as a command.
Correct. And that's what the Talmud says, too.
So, are we saying then that at that moment, there are more than seven Noahide laws?
Yes, you have to say that.
So, don't they...
But since that was not repeated over as a command, later on, the Talmud says, on 59b, in Sanhedrin 59b, the Talmud asks, well, you're telling me that anything which was repeated over again after Sinai will apply to Noahide and Jew? Well, they say there's two things that were repeated over again. There was be fruitful and multiply, and then there was circumcision was given over again. But the Talmud answers, no, they weren't given over as new commands. They were just new details were given over. So since it wasn't given over again in terms of a command, but just now elaborating on the how to do it, so that's not considered something which is repetition, and therefore it is no longer applicable. But it was applicable prior to that. But even so, it was a limited group. You're right. Like I said before, like circumcision was Abraham, his lineage.
Oh, so you're not claiming that circumcision devolved upon all of mankind at that time?
No, it seems to be it was just the Noahides from Abraham. But nonetheless, that was Noahide.
Okay, and the same with the Gidhanasha, that it devolved upon the descendants of Jacob, who were Noahides at that time.
Right, and as I think Tosos quotes, that the Israelites did that. It doesn't say, so that means only the descendants of Israel, not the other Noahides. Nonetheless, they were still Noahides. So it still had a status of Noahide law, albeit that it was for a select few.
But then, okay. But then, we have a system in place before Sinai that basically is a scattering, if you will, of rules that apply to everybody, plus a few that apply to only subgroups.
That's correct.
It's...
Yeah.
How does the circumcision for B'nai Keturah, that I think Rabbi Sheik said that they might still be obligated?
Right.
And if it was repeated for the Jew, I mean, you would think that, according to what you're saying, that they would not be, right?
If it was repeated in the command, then it would not be. The Talmud takes that up, because the Talmud says, you see that circumcision is repeated again. So the Talmud responds, no, it's not repeated as you shall circumcise, it's repeated as you can do it even on the eighth day, even if it's the Sabbath. It gives a detail. So a detail is not considered repetition of the command. But what you're asking, you're saying that if it was given to the Keturah, to that was Hagar, so if it was given also not only to Abraham's children from Sarah, but also to Abraham's children from Keturah, so that would stay intact. It would be transferred over, I guess, to them today. It wouldn't be abrogated from them. Since it was never repeated over, so then the way it was given originally was given to... let me just think about this one second. This is a good question you're bringing up. Because if we're saying that something which was not repeated over again is transferred away from the Noahide and now to the Jew... So circumcision is one of those. So that belongs now to the Jew. Now what about the Keturah? So maybe that's the actual question, is that Abraham's other wife, Keturah, since it wasn't repeated over, so you say on the one hand, well, it's transferred away from Noahide, but since that was given to Abraham, and he keeps circumcision because he now became the Jew, so perhaps also that applies to Keturah as well. That principle of staying with Abraham's lineage, so just like circumcision is going to be applicable now, not to other Noahides outside of Abraham's lineage, but only to Abraham's lineage, so part of his lineage is Keturah. So that would make sense that even Keturah, meaning Ishmaelim, would have to do circumcision. I think Maimonides actually says that.
I think that there was something that Ishmael would not, because it was sort of given to Abraham as a commandment afterwards, or I'm not sure exactly about the details, but...
Yeah, we have to look at that.
That's what I think, yeah.
Let me see. It says that right over here. He says that this is Laws of King 10:6. Actually, 10:7. He says circumcision is commanded on Abraham and his seed alone. All right? As it states, you and your seed after you, excluding the seed of Ishmael. Because it says, in Isaac will your seed be called. Okay? And also excluding Esav. Because Isaac said to Jacob, his son, God will give the blessing of Abraham to your seed. And he said that only to Jacob. That excludes Esav. He says, therefore, the rule is that he and his seed alone of Abraham that sees on to the law and into the upright life, they're the ones that are commanded in the circumcision. Okay, so according to Maimonides, Ishmael is excluded as well as Esav. So it's only the lineage straight from Jacob down. That's Maimonides.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So I think I see one of the confusions then, at least with regard to the point two that I raised in the email to you. In your article, you wrote about circumcision and Gittin HaShah and such as Noahide commandments, and in the sense that they were given to Abraham and or given to the sons of Jacob, who were still Noahides at the time, that would be true. When I read the word Noahide, I automatically presume that's something that devolves upon all of mankind.
Right, everybody from Noah and down, meaning predating it.
Yeah, and that's why I took issue, because I thought, well, wait a minute, those never applied to all the rest of us.
Right.
Just to those groups. So I think that, on that point, that clears up my confusion.
Okay. But we understand now also is that the reason why, is it clear that we understand why repetition applies to both? Meaning why God, when God repeated those seven at Sinai, so the repetition is not needed for the one group already that he's giving the rest of the laws to. That's something which is, because I'm viewing it as an addition, an addendum. So why is the repetition? To teach you something else. A lot of times the Torah does something, it repeats something, but it's not, you can't just simply read it. Oh, it's repeating it just to remind you. No. There's no redundancy in Torah. So therefore, the repetition must be to teach a new idea. And that is to tell the other Noahides that were not at Sinai that you still have to maintain your system. Don't look at this as now being a replacement. It's really an addendum. And it's an addendum to the Jew. And to show it's an addendum, you still have to keep what's given to you. That was not abrogated. And so repeating over those seven identifies which ones the Noahide still has to maintain.
So I'm a little confused by that point. And here's why. If I had a group of people, and it seems like it's the whole world, and I said, here you do this, and then I go to Sinai, and I say, okay, I'm going to repeat this, plus I'm going to add some new stuff. It would seem to me like the addendum would be to what I started with, not the other way around. And not, in other words, not like now I'm giving the 613 at Sinai and the 7 are an addendum to that, or am I misunderstanding you?
Yeah, the 613, well, actually the 603, let's say we assume there were 10 laws prior, because you had the 7 Noahide plus circumcision is 8, procreation is 9, the sciatica is 10. So the addendum would then be the 603 new, never before stated laws. And that's being addended to the, I think, is addended a word? I don't know. Let's say
it works.
it's an appendage to the existing laws. But what about the reason for? So it is the 603 new ones are being added on.
Okay.
And there's a nice idea that we'll go into a second in terms of the three categories of thought, speech, and action. We'll go into that in a second. But you're asking what exactly?
So I thought you were saying that So given that, can you repeat then what you were saying about why God repeated them?
So they're repeated not for the Jew, but they're repeated in order to indicate that the other system is still intact of the seven Noahides. Those have to be maintained. This is not to be looked at as a new system which overrides everything previous. Because there is a tendency to assume that, oh, here's a whole new system God's given to mankind. That means the other one is outdated. It has expired. It's being overwritten. The answer is no, it's not. And that's derived from the repetition of laws. You don't need to repeat the laws that were given to this group already.
Okay, I'm with you. That makes sense.
And those that were not repeated... Yeah, go ahead, Josh.
The danger there would be then, okay, that the Noahide would say, okay, this is a new system.
And the old system. And the old system.
And it only... it's just laws for Israel.
Right.
So that must mean that the old system's done away with, and the old system applied to me, so now I'm basically can do whatever I want.
Right.
That would be the danger, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Got some feedback there.
So my other question was, then how do you know which laws, like of the Jewish laws, the Noahites are allowed to take on, and which one they get, like Shabbat, they can't take, you know, they can't have Shabbat. But so how do you figure that out with other laws?
In terms of a Noahide taking on more laws, so my explanation, and I could be wrong, but what I see is that those things which would blur the lines between the Jew and the Noahide is what he came to. You have to turn down the... Okay. So whatever would give a misconception as to who the actual Torah recipients, that you can't have a Noahide keeping. You know, like keeping the Sabbath, which is a very prominent display, studying Torah, you know, halacha, the oral law, you know, outside the areas that they're allowed to. I would think maybe even tefillin, because that's a very apparent thing as well. So anything which, if an onlooker would look at the Noahide, now he can't tell the Noahide from the Jew. So the danger there is that since the Noahide is not commanded in so much of the Torah, so the meticulous care to understand everything well for practice isn't there. He doesn't have to practice it. But if he parades around keeping the Sabbath and wearing the tefillin and so on, so this can mislead a person who is ignorant, and he'd go to the Noahide to find out what Torah is. And since the Noahide is not that careful in terms of studying things because he doesn't have to keep all these laws, it'll create a new system of Torah that will not be as meticulously governed and propagated. It's not because there's anything wrong with the Noahide keeping the Shabbos. What it does is it may blur the lines as to who the real Torah authorities are, and then you end up having Torah authorities or assumed Torah authorities that people go to, and they don't have the fluency in all the areas because they don't have to keep it. So the odds are, you know, they're not going to be studying all those different areas. So then you end up, they pass down Torah to people, but then it becomes a very corrupt Torah because they didn't have to study it as much as the Jew who has to keep all these laws. So just as a rule, that's what I'm suggesting. If you give me just 1 second, I just want to look up something. But just to repeat, so that, you know, the Talmud says that the repetition, anything which is repeated over a Sinai, it applies to both. I think that supports my theory that if they didn't repeat it over, then you'd think they wouldn't have to do it anymore, because you look at Sinai as a whole new replacement. Oh, it's a new system. The old system's gone. You see how I'm thinking? Okay. 1 second. go. Okay. All right. Is that clear, Naomi? Okay, I'm going to take that as a yes. Okay. All right. So now the question, Doug, how are we holding? How are you?
I'm good.
Okay, because you had a few, like four questions. So you want to?
Yeah, I've got three more. So let me tackle the next one, which is the idea that we take seven laws and we add 603 new ones. But the seven laws have been taught to us as categories that actually break up into a much greater number of individual commandments when you look at them sort of at the same level of granularity as you look at the 613.
Okay.
And so in that sense, in terms of adding new ones to the system, you could make the argument that it's not 603.
Okay, that's all right.
Okay.
But the principle, let me just lay down a principle here, and that is, again, okay, that when God gave the new system of let's say it is 603, for argument's sake, so whatever that new addition, that new addendum was, you see that as time went on, you know, like I mentioned also that you didn't have laws prior to this. Why not? Why didn't God just give Adam 613 laws? Well, you couldn't. It's impossible, because how could you give Adam a law of Passover? How could you give Adam a law of don't copy the Canaanite people? They didn't exist yet. And Passover didn't exist yet, so you can't be, it doesn't make any sense. So you see how things were added on to address certain things that took place through time. So it's a progression. But then once the final system was given at Sinai, so you see that what God is doing is now he's saying this is the new system of perfection. Prior to Sinai, man only had this system. That was all that was necessary. But as man corrupted himself and certain events took place and certain false idolatrous practices began to propagate, so there was a need to address those. So the new system is now for perfection, which now we ask, so then what is the current day or the post-Sinai system of the Noahide laws if it's not for perfection? So we had mentioned this before, but I'll reiterate it now. So, as Rabbi Chait said, it's the minimum system to earn a human being his right to life. Meaning, this is the minimum threshold of tolerance that God will have to allow a person to live. If he cannot keep these seven, any infraction whatsoever, even if he steals a penny, he is killed for that. Because if you cannot keep a minimum system, forget it. It's like, for example, if a person doesn't have a certain minimum intake of calories, he'll die. All right? And it doesn't matter which calorie you diminish. But if you have a person who's taking 10 times that many calories, so if he, you know, if he skimps here and there, so it's not something which is going to kill him. Similarly with a Jew. If a Jew steals a penny, so he is not killed for that. You could say because since the system he has is a whole system of perfection, so that is not something which is going to drop him below the threshold. Because he has other things that are going to bring him back into line. He has laws of repentance, things of that nature. And he has, you know, has many, many other laws too. So the system which used to be for perfection now was now transferred over completely to the Torah system. And, you know, the Talmud says in the beginning of the Talmud of Avodah Zarah, which is the Talmud, the tractate on idolatry, that God did offer the Torah to the other nations, but they rejected it. So it's not that God has any favoritism, but it was Abraham who discovered God, who understood monotheism, who taught it, and now God said that this will be the one that will hold the Torah for the rest of the nations, and it says in Deuteronomy that when other nations see these righteous and just commands, they'll say, how righteous are these people? And they'll be very impressed. So you see that the Torah itself contains the sentiment that it should be observed by the Jew to impress everybody else on earth of God's greatness. And we say in Aleinu, in our prayers we say every day, that all sons of flesh will eventually call God's name. That's really our wish. And as Rabbi Chaim explained too, that when Moses saw the Egyptian that was smiting the Jew, and so Moses looked both ways, and he saw there was no one around, and he killed the Egyptian. He saved the life of the Jew. But what does it mean he looked and he saw that there was no Jew? So simply it means there was nobody around. Well, that doesn't say he didn't see any Jews. He didn't see anybody. There ain't each. There was no man around. So that has to make sense, of course. Literally, what took place in terms of the natural, the physical event on Earth? Was it, you know, Moses wanted to make sure he was doing justice, but he didn't want to put himself, he didn't want to do it in a way that would cause his own death. So if other Egyptians saw him killing a fellow Egyptian, he would be risking his life. So, but Rabbi Chaim quoted Yonatan ben Uzziel that says that Moses looked with his wisdom into the future and saw that there would be no descendant of this Egyptian that would convert or would do repentance. So therefore, you see, what does it mean he looked at the future? That means there was a prophecy he had at that point. And Rabbi Chaim explained that typically a man has to just judge cases based on the current facts that he has in front of him. But in terms of God's method of administering justice, he can look to all ends of all generations. And that's a higher level of justice. That there could be mitigating factors. Like, and that was what we just read in yesterday's Torah section, is that God says to Abraham, am I going to keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do to Sodom and Amorah? And Abraham is going to be a leader, and he's going to command his household afterwards to keep righteousness and justice, you know, righteousness and justice in his house. But you look what God says. He says, well, I keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do. Evidently, if God did not communicate something to Abraham, it would be hidden. Meaning there's only so far a man can go in terms of studying the world and coming and arriving at ideas about God. So God says there will be something hidden. And what is that hidden thing? So he said to Abraham, the cry of Sodom is great and has come before me. And now I will descend and I will see whether I will do in according with their cry and they'll be destroyed or otherwise. So now Abraham pondered that statement. This is why is God now mentioning this to me? It must be that outside of what I can see, meaning Abraham had no question that the righteous have to be sustained and the wicked have to be destroyed. So that's what he says to God. Are you going to kill the righteous with the wicked? No, far be it from you. The one who judges the whole world won't do righteousness? Of course not. So that was not a question. That was his opening statement. But then Abraham understood that if God was now introducing a dialogue, it must be he wanted to inform Abraham of a new point within God's justice. So Abraham now understood, oh, maybe God, it's true that God would kill a sinner and sustain a righteous person. But perhaps there are mitigating circumstances that God would even sustain the sinner. And what would that be? If there could be some effect that he would have on other people. So that's why Abraham goes into the questions. Would you kill these five cities if there were 50 righteous people? If there were 45? If there was 40? And you take a look at Ibn Ezra and explains the breakdown. Because you go from 50 to 45, that's a ninth. 45 to 40 is, an eighth? 40 to 30 is 25%. Each time is growing in number, in a percentage. From 30 to 20, that's 30%. And from 20 to 10 is 50%. So each time, Abraham is escalating the percentage. How about if a larger percentage was missing or so on? Meaning he's understanding that God entered this dialogue to show him that there's another concept that you can't discover in the natural world and that God had to communicate it. And that concept is that even though somebody might be worthy of death, but he might be sustained if there's mitigating circumstances. And that's what Moses was looking at. And God opened up his mind to prophecy and he showed him, Moses, don't hesitate. You can kill this Egyptian because there is nobody that will come from him that will either will convert or will repent. So Moses killed him. But Rabbi Chaim drew out a beautiful point from here, and that was, that we discussed before, that you see that is really the preferred thing, though, is that the Egyptian or any Gentile would really convert and have the best system. So I'm just bringing this all up to show you that the Torah system is really the best system for any human being. And therefore, that replaced the previous system of Noahide. And since that's the case, you cannot have a law that a Noahide is going to have a prohibition on that the Jew won't. Because now you're telling me in one area, the Noahide is something more perfecting than the Jewish system. And that can't be. So that's why anything which was not repeated over at Sinai, intuitively you might have thought, like the Talmud asks, well, really, it makes more sense to say if it wasn't repeated over, so therefore it should still be part of the Noahide law, not the Jewish law. Because he gave it to the Noahide originally, he didn't repeat it over to the Jew, so it should still remain Noahide. But they say, no, that can't be, because since we have an understanding that the Torah system is really the new system of perfection, that has to contain, by definition, more than the no-hide system. You see?
Okay.
Sorry, hello?
Yes.
Sorry, I just have a little bit curious. Things like, I guess you could say circumcision, like we said, was taken away from Ishmael. Or I guess, could you say that it would be one of those things that is prohibited for Noahites to have a circumcision?
I don't think, didn't we discuss that once?
Let me check my notes. That's not immediately coming to mind, but we might have.
I thought that if you wanted to.
I think you had told me, I had asked about it at one point.
I thought it was permissible, no?
Yeah, you had told me that it says in the Mishnah Torah in the section on circumcision that it is permissible.
Yeah, that brings a bell to me as well. Let's see if we find it quickly. And that would fit in with the theory that that's not something which is apparent, like Shabbos, observance of the Sabbath, or wearing tefillin, or setting up schools to teach Torah. Those are all very apparent things, and that blurs the line. Something like this is a private type of a law.
I sure don't recall ever hearing that it is prohibited.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's see if it says it here. Pretty sure I remember that being it is permitted for the Noahide. He says it's permitted. If he says that, so it implies that if he wants to do it for the mitzvah, so he does it, and even a Jew could even perform it. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, Rabbi. What's the source?
Laws of Circumcision, Chapter 3, Law 7, at the end. The last line.
Chapter 3, verse 7.
Yeah, he talks about that if an idolater wants to cut the foreskin because of a wound or because of some boil that he was born with, right? So let's say an idolater has a son, and he wants to he has a wound on that limb. So he can't, it's prohibited for the Jew to do it, right? Because you don't save the idolater from death, but you also don't cause it. So you don't partake of saving a person who's living a corrupt life. Right? And a lot of times the Torah critics, the Bible critics, who want to say, you see, that the Jew says, go ahead and then kill the Gentile. No, it's that since there's the spreading of laws that are the worst law, you know, propagate idolatry in the world, right? That's the worst thing. That's a law against the, you know, idolatry is the worst thing. That was the command, according to that one view, the only one that Adam got. So therefore, to help sustain that, you don't do that. It makes perfect sense. You do not help to sustain idolatry. All right, you don't put a any human being in a dangerous situation, however, Maimonides says. Right? And he says, even though you're doing a mitzvah with this act of healing, even though the Jew, if he would help that limb of the person, and he would perform the circumcision just as the act of healing, right? Even though that does the mitzvah, it does the command of circumcision simultaneously, you don't do it because the intent was for healing. The intent was not for circumcision. Therefore, the Rambam says, Maimonides says, if the idolater intends on doing circumcision for the actual command, then it's permissible even for the Jew to do it. All right. So if it's prohibited for them to have circumcision, he couldn't say this. So here you derive that that is permitted.
Seems like that would that'd be kind of difficult for Jewish doctors. I mean, is a Jewish doctor required to verify whether his patient's an idolater?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure if there's any mitigating circumstance today that because of the danger they might put himself in, would it then be permitted? I don't know.
Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, Doug, so how many questions we have left for you?
Two. Let me, you'll have to call time when we have to. Probably the key one is, we're still back to the be fruitful and multiply question. So, was that given as a commandment to Noah? And then if so, can we truly say it was rescinded? Particularly if it's given in writing in the written Torah and God himself apparently commanded it, but we don't see any place where it was rescinded.
Right, it wasn't rescinded, but since it was not repeated, therefore it's not maintained by them anymore. Therefore, it's no longer an obligation.
So let me. I want to make an argument on that point. So let's say I'm a Gentile, and I see that, gee, God gave me this commandment, and it's very clear to me, and so I have to be fruitful and multiply. And then this event happens over here at Sinai. Now, I wasn't present there. Let's say I was over in some other city at the time, so I don't know what went on at Sinai. I would, seems to me, roll along thinking, well, God gave me a commandment and he hasn't rescinded it, therefore I'm obligated.
You're right, but ignorance is never an excuse.
Yes, but if God... I guess I'm bothered by the idea that God specifically gives the commandment, and then later we're saying, well, since God gave some other stuff to some other people and didn't repeat that one, therefore I'm off the hook. Somehow that doesn't...
Well, I explained it before, that the reason why that phenomenon makes sense is that the system of perfection is now the 613. And you can't have something still in the Noahide system that's going to exist, and it's not going to exist in the Jewish system, because the Noahide system is no longer a system of perfection. Originally, it was.
Yeah, but the commandment to be fruitful and multiply given by God to Noah, I can't believe was about perfection. That was about filling the earth, wasn't it?
Right. All right. I mean, there still is a perfecting quality in the fact that you're following God's will in that area.
Okay. And the command
And let me just address JHS was just writing online. He says that the procreation was given to Adam. Yes, JHS, but that was not given to anyone but him. So therefore, it wasn't a national law. It was a law just for him. The rabbis derived the law from when God gave the command to Noah. Okay? Just to address JHS. Doug, go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's okay. The command to procreate, however, was given to at Sinai to the Jews. Correct?
It was given to Noah, and it wasn't repeated.
It wasn't at Sinai, it was given to the Jewish people?
No, it wasn't repeated. That's the point. That's why it's no longer with the Noahide.
Well, I thought the Jewish people had an obligation to have a certain number of kids, or a boy and a girl.
That's a detail. Again, the actual command itself, I'll read it to you. See, they asked the question in the Talmud on 59b. They say, well, what do you mean that procreation was not repeated? It does. It says after Sinai that God initially told the Jews, separate from your wives 3 days before you get the Torah in order that you're in a right mental state and you're elevating yourself from any type of instinctual involvement. Then afterwards, he tells Moses, they tell the people they should go back to the tents, which means now resume procreation. So they ask a question. You see there's a command over there after Sinai to procreate. They say, no, that was for a separate reason that was brought down. The Talmud brings down a separate reason why that was there. It wasn't a command. It just says go to your tents also. So it's not even the words of the verse itself don't even say procreate. So they say clearly that since there was no new command, it was just that was mentioned for some other alternative message. So therefore, that is one of the laws that were not repeated and therefore were usurped from the Noahide system and now only exist in the Jewish system. Because the whole...
I'm sorry, in your very last sentence, you said that was one that was usurped. Which command are you talking about now?
Procreation. Procreation was usurped. It was part of the Noahide system, but once Sinai came, and since it wasn't repeated, we now have a rule. Anything which was not repeated at Sinai is now usurped from the Noahide system and exists only in the Jewish system.
Okay, but I thought you said that commandment isn't part of the 613 either, or it doesn't exist in the Jewish system.
No, it does, because it was now transferred over.
Okay, so I guess to cut to the chase, the real underlying question I think that the person in my class was asking was, do we have any sense of why that was?
Yes, I...
Why that particular command was...
I give
given
a theory.
Away from the world and given just specifically to the Jews.
I tried to give an explanation as to why these three, meaning the sciatica that you're not allowed to eat, and circumcision and procreation. Why are those three removed when they initially were part of the Noahide? The other seven stay with the Noahide, but those three removed. So what I wanted to say was like this, is that those three really embody... certain perfections, meaning the circumcision is the perfection of the person physically, his instinctual. So that's the whole purpose for circumcision. Maimonides brings it down that those who are uncircumcised, both male and female, have a greater attachment to the sexual act. There's more enjoyment for both the women and the man when intercourse involves a man who is uncircumcised. So he explains the actual act of circumcision is to minimize the physical gratification in order to divert man away from that type of a life. The sciatica, so that comes from an event where Jacob was wrestling with his man. It was like an internal battle, really. And he saw some element of his nature, and he worked on it, and he perfected himself. And... as Rabbi Chait says, whenever a person redirects his energies from one lifestyle and he raises himself to a higher lifestyle, so there's a slowdown of the flow of his energies until they start gaining momentum in the new area where he's living. So that's expressed by limping. It's a slow process to perfect oneself. So there, our abstention of eating the sciatica is to demonstrate that we want to perfect ourselves also in the internal world, not just the physical world, but internally, just like Jacob did. And procreation is that this people that embodies both areas of perfection should continue, that this is the sort of like it reflects back on those two. So I'm just trying to give a hopefully a satisfying explanation as to why these three were now put into the Jewish system, because this is really the system of perfection, and you can really boil down perfection into the controlling the instincts and then perfecting one's ideals. So it's the emotional and the intelligible areas of life. Those are the only two areas of life that we have.
Okay, I think I hear you. Thank you.
Okay. And interesting also is that you see that according to that Talmud that talks about that Adam had that one command and then he was supposed to have idolatry and then he was to derive from that also not cursing and also God and also setting up courts. So that now is a the paradigm of all human activity, which means thought. Idolatry primarily is what you accept in your mind, something other than God, that's thought. Speech, that's expressed by not cursing God. And action, setting up courts for all other laws. So you see that from the outset, God wanted all three areas of man's involvement, activity, to be governed by intelligence. And even after, even at Sinai, when the Ten Commandments were given, those also, Sadegon says beautifully, that those laws are really, they're two sets of five. And each one addresses, the first ones address laws between man and God. The second set addresses laws between man and man. But there's an order within each. In as much as man has a relationship with God, what is most primary is his concept of God. Not so much what he says or what he does. Therefore, what comes first in the order of the Ten Commands in the first set of five is, number one, accept God. Number two, don't accept idolatry. That's thought. Number three, don't use God's name in vain. That's speech. And four and five are Sabbath observance and honoring parents, which is physical action. So the order goes thought, speech, action, because the most important is mentioned first. But that's because your relationship with God is based on your concepts, more than based on your actions. Actions are mere expressions. However, in the second set of the Ten Commandments that address laws between man and man, the order is reversed, because what's most important in societal considerations is our actions. Therefore, the first law of the second set of five is don't murder. Second, don't commit adultery. The third one is don't bear false witness. That's speech. So the first two, kidnapping. So it's murder, adultery, and kidnapping. Those are all physical actions, and in the order of what's most important in physical actions, because in terms of having a society, the actions are more important than what you think. I mean, what you do to your fellow man is more dangerous than what you think about it. So the actions come first. Then the fourth of that second set is don't bear false witness, that's speech. And the last one is don't desire your friend's property, his wife, his animals, whatever it is. So that's thought. So it's beautiful how you see these categories carried over. And since, you know, man doesn't change, so those categories exist even by Adam. But now, since we had more infractions came up and there was more things to address, therefore, it was necessary to increase the law to address those things. But you see, it still kept the same original design of thought, speech, and action. And it's really, really beautiful when you can see that those underpinnings, the fundamentals are there. And you really have to derive it. Okay, any other questions or comments?
My only other last question was that I thought I picked up in your article that it suggested that the prohibition against a female captive developed upon a Noahide.
That's correct. The Talmud takes that up, and it says, because the Talmud finishes its idea by saying, you can't have any law that's prohibited by the Noahide and is not prohibited by the Jew, because the Jewish system is the more complete system, right? Okay, that makes sense. But then they ask the question, well, wait a minute. A Jew is allowed to take a female captive who's not Jewish and marry her when he's in war. right? And the Jew is not punished if he steals less than a pruta coin. I mean, there's a certain minimum that you have to steal in order to violate. So those two things the Jew is not punished for, but the Gentile is. So now the Talmud comes back and says, well, 1 minute, we now have a refutation of your idea. You originally wanted to say that there's nothing that the Noahide will be prohibited on and the Jew won't. But we just found two things that it is. So the Talmud answers. The reasoning is because why is it that the Noahide is punished in terms of the female captive? That is something which he cannot do, because the laws when you take over land, when you conquer land, that's not something which applies. So since he doesn't have that permission, the Jew does. The Jew can. His conquest of land is recognized. The conquest by the idolater is not recognized. So since it's not recognized, he doesn't have the permission when he's in war to do that. And so you can't just take that woman.
So does that fall then under theft?
Let's
figure out where would that fall in the seven Noahide.
I got to think about that.
Okay.
And the reason for the stealing is, like we said, the Talmud has another reason. He says that why is it that a Jew, if he steals less than a pruta coin from another Jew, he's not there's not really a punishment there. You know, according to the strict letter of the law. It's because they say the Jews have a quality of being forgiving. But he says other nations don't. And since other nations don't have that quality, so even if I steal less than that pruta coin amount, I'm still actually infringing on what another person really claims is his. Because since that quality, the Talmud is saying, it doesn't exist in other people, so then that will be an infraction by the Gentile. But it's not saying that stealing doesn't exist for both. Of course, stealing exists for the Jew. But there is extenuating circumstances that make one thing, the same exact act, would be prohibited by the Noahide and not by the Jew. But that's only these two. But in terms of the principle is there. You can't have something in the Noahide system that the Jewish system doesn't have, because the Jewish system is now the new system for perfection. The Noahide system now just becomes a system of...
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Okay. She's always on time, that one.
Yeah.
So that explains that.
Okay.
So I got to thank
you. Comment on the arguments that Doug presented earlier and see what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Noahide would say, okay, now I read I'm commanded, or Noah was commanded, be fruitful and multiply, but, look, then that's the commandment of Noah, I'm a Noahide, and I don't agree with the, what the Jews are telling me the system is. That's really, that argument really can't stand, because the only, I'm not saying that's not exactly the argument, I'm just paraphrasing, but the only reason this Noahide knows about the command to Noah for procreation is because of the prophecy of Moses transmitted by the Jews. He doesn't have any, transmission from Noah.
Well, Doug was talking about a
therefore,
case...
Therefore, he must accept the whole...
yeah, you're right.
...system and interpretation of, by the people that he received it from. He can't pick and choose.
But Doug's case was not that case. It wasn't subsequent to Sinai. Doug was saying that when Sinai was the Torah was being given, there was some other city where the Noahides didn't hear anything about Sinai. So he would keep on thinking that I have to continue procreating, because it was given to Noah, and it was never abrogated.
Right.
So there, he was talking about a current day situation. So we answered that ignorance doesn't,
Did such people exist at the time?
Well, I'm sure at Sinai, at that time, there were other nations, there were many other nations that, they had to wait until the Jews left and spread through the world, and the word of mouth, brought that information to them. But I'm sure that's a very real case that Doug was suggesting. But again, also, you have the principle of the Torah that a person who is not responsible for it is outside of his means. So if the Noahide, and it's not, nothing wrong with him procreating, it's just he wasn't commanded in it. But to assume that it was an obligation at the time of Sinai, he really couldn't have been responsible for assuming that, you know, incorrect notion, because the word from Sinai couldn't spread to him yet.
So were there still Noahides at that point keeping a transmission from Noah? Or
it doesn't seem so. It doesn't seem so because the Talmud talks about how they stopped keeping the system at a certain point.
Yeah.
I think we discussed that once. Interesting piece. You can take a look at the.
That's kind of my argument. If there was nobody, if there was no Noahide keeping the Noahide system and they only got it, then.
They have to follow what the Jews
from Sinai.
Yeah, they have to follow the Jewish explanation. Exactly. They would have to follow the Jewish explanation from Sinai forward.
Right. Yeah.
All right, any other questions? I think we have like a few minutes left. You can take a look, Josh. I did an article, I think it's online, about whether God ever released the Gentiles from keeping the seven laws. There's a on tractate. It's Avodah Zarah, and it's I think it's page 2B. So
I kind of remember reading. I don't remember exactly the details.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You take a look. I think it has on there. But maybe look up the source, Avodah Zarah, or put in like 2B, maybe you'd find it quicker.
Is it 2B?
Let's see, because 2B is typically not going to be part of any word, so maybe it'll show up. Let me see right now.
All right.
Let me see right now if I can tell you where it is.
Please note that your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
Let's see here. Let's see it. I'll see if I can locate it for you.
Okay.
Let's see if I can locate it for you. See it right offhand. But the basic idea was that since they didn't keep it, since there was a certain time where they were just not keeping the law, so then it's as if they were released, because there's a quote that brings down from the Torah that God released them from the system. That's only because they weren't keeping it out of a lineage straight back from Noah as God's will. They were keeping the seven commands because of just practical reasons, to set up a society. So they didn't receive reward anymore, because in order to get reward for following God's word, it has to be you're doing an act of following God's word. That has to be your intention when you do the action. If a person in the middle of the wilderness just starts to pick up a palm branch and shake it, that's not fulfilling the laws of Sukkos, of shaking the palm branch. He's just picking it up to wave for whatever personal reason. Similarly, at a certain point, they just stopped keeping it. So even if they resumed, since it was not done because of an understanding that it's God's will, so then there can't be any reward for that. Reward means that you are doing an act because you feel this is what God wants of me. So that was the crux of that issue there.
Okay.
All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up here. I'll pick up next week with Kahelis, all right?
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a great week, everybody.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.